Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome back to the Reformed Dissenters. We are the show where Reformed Christians dissent against popular ideas of culture by asserting a biblical worldview. I'm Bruce Johnson, joined, of course, by my brother Jacob Johnson.
Hello everybody.
And today we're also joined by a very special guest, Michael Harding. Welcome to the show, Michael. It's good to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And he wrote a book that is, I think, could not be more pertinent to our current situation. Yeah, Jake's got it there. And it is The Christian Response to Abortion, an Unapologetically Biblical Approach to Abolishing Preborn Homicide. So no holds barred, holding nothing back. It's kind of stating it as it is, which I think is tremendous. We need more of that today, especially when you see what, you know, two people we just talked about 2 weeks ago, Trump and Carrie Lake, did, which is utterly despicable. So it's, I think this is well-timed. This is a great continuation of the conversation we were literally just having. So we're just thrilled to have him on the show and discuss this. And we'll also link that website in the description below. But before we get into all that, this incredible conversation, we have to do what we always do, which is talk about our verse of the week. And of course, it's a passage because we can't just do one verse. That would be insane. Today we are talking about Psalm 37, verses 10 and 11. This passage says, "In just a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace." And that's Psalm 37, 10 through 11. I think, especially given our conversation today, this hits home. The Psalms are just incredible because David holds nothing back. There are imprecatory Psalms. There are Psalms like Psalm 2 talking about, "Be warned, be wise, O rulers of the earth, kiss the sun, lest he be angry and you perish in the way." There are strong Psalms that cut right to the heart of the matter, and I think this is no different. I wanted to actually back up and read from verses 8 through 15 and kind of give some further context to this passage, just because I think it's so powerful. Psalm 37, 8 through 15 says, "Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself. It tends only to evil. For the evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land." There's that strange theme again. "In just a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there." And here it is again. "But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace. The wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes his teeth at him. But the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming. The wicked draw the sword and bend their bows to bring down the poor and needy, to slay those whose way is upright. Their sword shall enter their own heart, and their bows shall be broken." So obviously this is a very post-millennial show, which all of you know. And so we very much address matters of Christ's kingship when we're discussing how culturally involved we should be. And I think the topic we're going to discuss today is no different, because so many would say, well, this is just the law of the land. This is just the way it is. You have to make your peace with it. And there are so many of those issues today where we're just told as a church, just make peace with it. This place is not our home. This earth is not our home. We're just pilgrims passing through. And there is not a thing we're supposed to do, apparently, which I think this passage couldn't disagree more with that philosophy of don't be involved. We're not supposed to sit on the sidelines. We're not supposed to, not only are we supposed to take no part in the evil works of darkness, we're supposed to expose them. We're supposed to conquer. We're supposed to be going forth and discipling the nations. This is not a weak-willed faith. This is a faith of action, and particularly when there are lives on the line. And so as we discuss this passage, I think throughout the rest of this week, one of the biggest things we're going to talk about is the demise of the wicked, is the ending of their schemes, is how little power they actually have, even when it looks like the kings and the rulers of the earth take their stand together against the Lord and against his anointed, right? They do not have nearly the amount of power that they believe they do, and they will not possess the amount of power they have, even the small amount of power they have, they will not possess that for much longer. But as Christians, we're called to take action. We're called to get to work. We're not waging war according to the flesh, but our weapons of warfare, because we are at war, have the power, the spiritual weapons of warfare have power to destroy strongholds and every lofty argument and to take every thought captive for Christ. And so that's what we're doing. And I think this conversation today is one of the most practical, one of the most potent, and one of the most important parts of society and culture where we need to take this theology and apply it to today. So reintroducing Mr. Michael Harding once again, I'll just kind of introduce him. Michael Harding, also known as Mike, is an unashamed follower of Jesus Christ. He is husband to Emily and father to Joanna, Hannah, and Sam, whose time on earth in mommy's belly was short but cherished. Mike has previously published one other book titled 35 Days in Paul's Letter to the Philippian Church. Mike is a 2009 to 2010 Operation Iraqi Freedom veteran who served 9 years in the Army National Guard. He writes with passion and commitment to see the practice of the slaughtering of the preborn image bearers of God abolished once and for all. So, Mike, again, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm honored to get the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so you're kind of making the rounds through the shows, and we heard about you from Greg Moore, actually, the Dead Man Walking podcast, and he was like, you got to have this guy on. He's talking about some really important stuff. And we both, Jake and I, ordered a copy of your book, and Jake's came in. Mine hasn't, so I'm looking forward to the day when mine's here. But we were just going through it, and some of the messaging in there is so potent and so powerful. Would you mind just telling us a little bit about, you know, maybe why you in particular have decided to write this book, why you've chosen to tackle this particular issue, what's driving you to do this, some of your experiences behind that?
Yeah. So one of the things that I noticed as I became more convinced of what I would call a biblical position on abortion, initially my position was, I'm giving to pregnancy resource centers, which isn't bad. Like that's a start, right? But what I realized was that's not enough. And by and large, the thing that was hindering me was the size of the enemy. Sometimes we can do, you know, find ourselves in really paralysis by analysis. And I was that for many years. I wouldn't say that I like celebrated you know, an incremental bill or things like that. I didn't really pay enough attention to it. I was just living my life and thinking that I was doing enough, that I would vote for the right candidates, and that's how it was all going to be taken care of. And then when I realized that's not the case, when I was introduced to the biblical position, I had no other option but saying, okay, well, the word says this, and I'm seeing pastors, legislators, friends of mine doing the exact opposite. And so I began to seek out people who were active in this space, pro-life and abolitionist, trying to learn more about these things. And what I realized was in some of these groups, and I won't name the groups because I don't think it would be helpful right now, but in some of these groups, it was more about a name and not as much about the position or actually seeing abortion ended. It was more about internal politics or the idea that, you know, one person's practical solution to ending abortion was it. And all I wanted to know as a Christian was, what does the Bible say? And so that sent me on a journey of researching and studying. And I was heavily influenced by a man that wrote the foreword to my book. His name's Bill Askell. And if you have not heard that man preach, you need to look him up at Bethel Baptist Church in Owosso, Oklahoma. Awesome expositor. But he has been a faithful minister of the gospel for, I think it's been almost 40 years. He spent 18 years at the church that he's at now. Just awesome, awesome man of God. And most people know him by being the guy at the Southern Baptist Convention that stood up with a baby and showed the baby in the sense that they were trying to make some motions and trying to shoot down a resolution. And he said, look, everybody always thinks abolitionists are angry, and they were trying to paint that narrative. And he's like, no, I have a baby. Yeah. And I'm speaking very kindly. I'm summarizing the whole thing. But that was the moment that the world was in many ways introduced to Bill Askell on the abolitionist stage. But yeah, so he's been heavily influencing me over the last couple of years. And I realized that though there were many brothers that were writing great work on constitutional like arguments and things like that, and there were many articles written about the biblical response, there wasn't actually like a book devoted solely to this is what the Bible says, and here's the doctrine of equal standards of justice. And so, in short, that was what drove me to that. And I did so realizing, even at the beginning of my book, I state this, that there are many men and women who have been at this a lot longer than I have and whose shoulders I stand on and am very thankful for.
Yeah, that's excellent. I want to come back to this a little bit later. You mentioned that equal standards of justice. And I really want to come back to that in just a second, but I think we'd be remiss of our duties here on the show if we didn't ask for your perspective and opinion on, I'm sure you've heard the whole Carrie Lake Trump debacle that went down 2 weeks ago, where we basically, Trump was like, oh, we're at a legally acceptable place. Aren't we at a great place with abortion, right? This was it. This is what you wanted me to do, right? And, you know, kind of the truth to us, at least, we were expressing that to us, it seemed like the truth was finally coming out. And this was literally just a political game for him. This was literally just a talking point to get his base to vote for him. And clearly, he doesn't actually believe it's murder, or he wouldn't be okay with some states saying it's murder and others saying it's not.
Yeah.
Right? But what was your take on that whole situation?
Yeah, I'll start in a way that probably you're not expecting and might get a few people angry. But that's okay. I'll start with this question. And I heard it from somebody that I think was very, very suiting for the discussion. When's the best time to plant a tree?
When's the best time? I don't know.
20 years ago. 20 years ago. When's the second best time? Right now.
Probably now.
Yeah. And so when I'm thinking about this discussion with Trump as a politician, because he's a politician, just like many of the others that we've run into, I've done a lot of legislative lobbying and things for bills of equal protection. I'm on the board of End Abortion Ohio. And we have seen these excuses come up all over the place, even before Trump, right? Like the pro-life movement, the industrial complex, not individual pro-lifers, but the leaders of the pro-life movement are seeking not to end abortion completely. They just want to legislate it. And so that's the big difference is that you have individual pro-lifers and abolitionists alike that are actually seeking the end of abortion. We may not agree on the solution to how that would happen, incremental versus immediatist, but generally Christians that despise abortion are seeking for it to be completely ended. When it comes to the pro-life industrial complex, they just want it to be legislated. Trump, several years ago, and I forget exactly when this happened, he actually, for all of, I don't know, 20 seconds, held a abolitionist position, equal protection position. He was asked if a woman is the chief offender in the abortion issue, which I'm going to argue is the case. If she's the chief offender in abortion, should she be punished? And he said, yes. And then within a very short amount of time, his wrist was slapped and he was told that's not actually the pro-life position. He walked it back. Right. So, from then on, I mean, I already had my suspicions, with him, and I'll be forthright in saying I voted for him the first couple of elections because I had bought into a narrative that was choose the lesser of two evils. Right. My position now is, and the reason I stated that quote about the question about the tree, my position now is that we need to start holding the Republican Party accountable. And the only way we can truly do that is by our vote. So if Christians refuse to vote for candidates that compromise on the issues that matter to us, which Trump does on just about every single one, if we in unison vote for somebody, even if that person doesn't win and that person loses, even though there are many people who are so afraid of Trump losing, they misunderstand the sovereignty of God in the whole process. Like,
amen.
If we all unifiedly voted, and I'm just going to put this out here, write in Dusty Deaver's name. I know he's probably like, shoot, I don't want to be president right now, but write in his name. And if there's 100,000 Christians, just as there were 100,000 Muslims in Michigan that put backlash back onto Biden in regards to the or, you know, save Palestine from Israel, then wouldn't we, you know, see a huge shift in the next candidate that's brought forward for us to vote for? Do you think they would walk it back if they realized they were going to lose a huge voting bloc? I think they would. I think the only reason that they're bringing the candidates that they are right now is because they know what's going to happen is people are going to hold their nose, walk into the voting bloc, and you know, say, I don't like him, but it's the only option we have. And we need to stop doing that. We need to just say enough's enough. So there you have it. That's my position.
Our position. Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's been our position on the show for the last, I don't know, what, year, Jake? Ever since this election cycle started, we were like, you know, we're not voting for Trump. And we're not voting for him just because we're never Trumpers. Like, we're not never Trumpers in that way.
We did vote
don't
for
believe
him
he's a biblical
early
candidate.
On. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I voted for him in 2020. But that was, you know, when everything was going down and it seemed like he was actually sort of on the right side of things. He did give his presidency to Fauci. But still, it seemed like, all right, maybe he's going to, you know, get through this. But I mean, the last, what, 3-4 years, what has he done? He's not stood for anything that he used to say that he stood for. And it's kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, we knew this. We knew he was playing the game. He was doing, you know. Yes, God used him to overturn Roe v. Wade. God used him to do all these things, but it is long since time for us to move on, and especially for Christians to find an actual Christian candidate who is not just the lesser of two evils, like you were just saying, but who is actually someone who cares about legislating biblical morality, because somebody's morality is going to get legislated either way. And if it's not God's morality, then the nation is going to go down. Like, that's what happens. That's how history works. So, Jake, unless you had something you wanted to bring up.
I was probably going to bring up chapter 4 because I know we wanted to get into that sort of discussion.
Yeah. Let's go there. Yeah. What were some of the things that, cause Jake, you kind of skimmed through it and were doing some stuff.
I mean,
what was like the,
here, hold on. Let me get back to it. So I remember. So basically, the she is not a victim is she is not a victim is the title of the chapter, and I personally I liked the points in it. I liked everything that was being discussed. But can you expound a little bit on what you were explaining in that chapter?
Yeah, so it's really hitting at the heart of the issue, right? If we call the woman a victim, then we are in reality stealing the gospel from her. Because victims have no reason to repent. They did nothing wrong. And so we've come to a point as a society, and I'm primarily talking about Christians, to where we have in our niceness chosen to be nicer than Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. Like Jesus calls people to repentance. He identifies sins. And yes, that's people who sin very grievously. And sin is always messy and emotional, right? Especially those that are life and death, like abortion. And don't get me wrong, there are women that are coerced. And in that sense, there is victimhood there, right? Like they're being forced into a situation that they did not want to do. Clearly, the law's going to deal with that differently. The laws that we already have on the books for homicide deal with coercion. But what I'm primarily talking about is the woman who is shouting her abortion, the woman who is flying
it live on TV.
Yep. And so it's not the exceptions. Yes, of course, there are women in general that might be actual victims, but not primarily of the abortion industry. It's actually very, very rare in my experience standing outside abortion mills to find a woman who does not know it's a baby like that. And in fact, I've yet to be outside an abortion mill and find a woman who is going in voluntarily to get an abortion that does not know that it's a baby in her belly. We live in the 21st century. There's internet. People, what do you do when you don't know something? You Google it. Right. Yep. It's not always the most accurate, but like at this point, that argument, we've had ultrasounds for a long time. That argument is long gone. For most of the women.
That's a really good way of putting it. One of the things I was saying, Jake and I were discussing this a bit earlier, and you know, I was bringing up the fact that, you know, so many women maybe previously, and I kind of was under the maybe illusion, I guess, that we were still kind of in that zone. I said, you know, 5 to 10 years from now, I don't think, you know, it's going to be possible for us to, you know, make the argument that they didn't know any better. I think 5 to 10 years from now, because of how prolific the pro-life movement has been and putting out material and, you know, reaching out to so many people in there, like God has clearly blessed the pro-life ministry in America. So I was thinking, you know, 5 to 10 years from now, they probably wouldn't have that, you know, be able to say, I didn't know. But maybe that's today. Maybe we're already at that point and I didn't even realize, you know, how far it was spreading. So that's exciting. I think one part of it too is, you know, you could also take it from a spiritual point of view and say, well, you know, what does Romans 1 tells us? Mm-hmm. It tells us there they know the truth, because what could be made, you know, known about God has been made plain to them. But they suppress the truth and unrighteousness. And so, you know, we say, you know, we're presuppositionalists. So we say, you know, everyone deep down knows that they know God, but they're suppressing the truth about God and unrighteousness. Right. And so when you debate someone, when you discuss with someone, you go into it with that presupposition. And so would you make the same case for abortion? Would you say sort of the same sort of thing? Like they know deep down, or is it just because it's so prolific and because it's so widely known?
Brother, you just hit on the key point within the biblical argument, right? Like the truth is written on every heart. Like we know when we're sinning, right? We just choose to silence our conscience. God has just as you said, Romans 1, like there's no excuse. There isn't. Like it's just, they get to the point to where they're just regurgitating the same things. And yes, maybe there are people who have been educated back in the day. I actually knew a woman that she said before there were ultrasounds and stuff, she legitimately for her first abortion did not, like she thought it was a clump of cells. So at some point that was the argument to some degree. She still knew like something was wonky about what she was doing, right? Like there was still this inkling. Yeah. In fact, I'll read her story, here. And so it's on page 36 in chapter 4. So I said, I want to share a story with you from a very special woman who loves Jesus named Bonnie Coffee Cannon. Mrs. Bonnie was once very much pro-abortion during a time when we didn't have the same technologies we do now and had 3 abortions done. She was so convinced that what she was doing wasn't murdering a child that she paid for a friend to murder her child as well. It used to be the case that prior to ultrasound technologies, many believed that the baby in the womb was nothing more than a clump of cells. Bonnie understood the baby to be a potential life, not life from conception. However, by God's grace, this perspective was radically changed when she saw pictures and videos from an undercover sting on abortion clinics selling aborted baby parts. Bonnie's story is one of much pain and redemption. Here it is in snapshot form from Bonnie herself. So, 3 abortions, also paid for a friend to have an abortion. Here's her story. I am a post-abortive woman who has been redeemed by the blood of Jesus Christ. I was vulnerable. I was scared. I was abandoned. I was pressured to abort. The first baby's father was a CPS caseworker who threatened to take away my 6-year-old son if I caused problems for him. The second baby's father said he couldn't care less what I did because he had no intention of paying me a dime for the baby. The third abortion was a doctor who assaulted me on the exam table and tried to forcibly abort the baby. But even though I was attacked, assaulted, threatened, deceived by pro-abort information and did not realize I was murdering a human being, I always knew that I alone was responsible for my actions. My own decision It was my own choice. I decided to abort. I located the abortion clinic. I took the baby in my womb, and I laid down for him or her to be torn apart. I would have never dreamed of even attempting this if it had been legally considered murder. When I saw a graphic, bloody photo of an actual 9-week aborted victim, I was horrified and realized I had murdered 3 of my children. I had also paid for someone else's abortion. It was only then that I got down on my knees and begged Christ to forgive me for murdering my children. I knowingly killed 4 innocent human beings. I am not a victim. I am a mass murderer who deserves the death penalty. The absolute best way to protect vulnerable women from abortion is to outlaw all of it as murder from conception, without exception, and treat abortion homicide like any other homicide, exempting no one from prosecution. We must not second guess God. He established the justice system, It is up to us to abide by it. So that is a woman who, during a time, would have had every excuse, right? Like, she would have been, even by Christians, written off as like, oh, you just didn't know. You didn't know. But what she needed was the gospel. She needed to be confronted in her sin.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you so much for writing this book, putting this together, for your work on this front. I saw, I think it was on your website, and 50% of all the proceeds go to prevent abortion. Mm-hmm. So that's so encouraging. So where is it people can go again to get your book?
Yeah. So it's thechristianresponse.org. So type in thechristianresponse.org. And so the 50% right now for the first 500 books, I'm kind of going to be cycling through different organizations that I think are doing a wonderful job in this fight. And the first 500 go to one near and dear to my heart that I helped found, which is End Abortion Ohio. And so I'm on the board, but there's 2 guys heading it up. You have Nick Callis and Austin Beigel, who have been slugging it out there in Ohio. But then after that, I am going to be finding different organizations that I think are doing a wonderful job. And they get 50% of the proceeds for a designated number of books, and then we rotate to another. But it's just going to keep going indefinitely as long as the book sells. So, yeah.
Nice. That's great. That's so great. So if, real quick, we have a couple of minutes. If people wanted to get involved in this, let's say they maybe for the first time are hearing about this, or they're just realizing, oh man, this is something like I need to get involved here. What's the best path forward in from your perspective for someone who, you know, wants to do whatever they can to, you know, put a stop to this? What's the best way forward?
Yeah. So in my book, I actually have a section on action steps, ways in which they can get involved, different ways that they can contact their legislators, go out to the abortion mills, petition pastors, because there are a lot of pastors that still are being educated on this, and it's okay. We all have to arrive at different points, right? Like we got to be patient with people as they make a transition to a biblical position. But I would say, in addition to everything, the most important argument to be had here is we look at the doctrine of equal standards of justice. And it's one that I make in my book, is that we can't understand the substitutionary atonement without the doctrine of equal standards of justice. And I'll let people think on exactly how that applies, and they'll have to read the book to see how I unpack that. But just think about it. We don't understand the doctrine of the substitutionary atonement outside the doctrine of equal standards of justice.
Wow. That's fascinating. Well, I can't wait till my book gets here and I get to read it. So. Yeah. Well, very cool. Thank you so much, Mike Harding, for joining us today. We really appreciate that. We'll have a link to his website in the description below, so you all should definitely check that out. We're looking forward to coming back once again on Friday, where we're discussing Adam Terrell's book, Public Stoning, God's Design for a Nation Without Prisons. Until then, remember, everyone, in all that you do, do it as unto the Lord.